Blog Talk Radio.
Listeners, welcome to Military Monday on the RateStream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham, and I'm not going to lie to you, it stinks in Fairfax, Virginia. We thought we were going to get a couple inches of light snow for the spring. There's a foot out there. There's a bloody foot of snow on the ground on St. Patrick's Day, and there's still more coming. Tomorrow the Cherry Blossom Festival goes and starts, and it's snowing. And Thursday is the first day of spring, and it's snowing. Now, I'm going to quit whining because we have got a really, really, really great show today. Every now and again, a book comes across my desk for review and thoughtful consideration for a show that just appeals to whimsy. And this is one of those shows. I doubt that any of us who love military history or the military would not recognize Alfred Eisenstadt's classic photo taken on VJ Day in August of 45 in Times Square, which is known popularly as the Kissing Sailor. It's a picture taken in the middle of Times Square at the height of the celebration of a sailor bending over a beautiful nurse in her white nurse's outfit and giving her a big smooch, celebrating the end of man's greatest war and generally reflecting the hope and the optimism that maybe it would be the last one. Maybe it would be the last one their generation would have to fight. Now, this great photo was just part of an amazing generation of photographers and photography that helped the world rationalize and visualize the conflicts of that period. And today we're going to go and talk to a couple of very, very intriguing authors. They have written a history of this photo. Mind you, you say, how can you write a history book about a photo, something that maybe took a 60th of a second for one of the great photographers in the history of the game to shoot? And yet they've done it, and they've done a very comprehensive job of researching it and answering some of the really intriguing questions about it. The book is called The Kissing Sailor. It is put out by our good friends at the U.S. Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, Maryland. And the authors are Lawrence Vieira and George Galdovich. And there is a wonderful foreword by David Hartman, the former host of Good Morning America. And without further ado, I want to bring on our two guests and introduce them to you. George, Larry, are you there, guys?
We are.
George?
I'm here also, John.
Very good. I'm going to let you guys introduce yourselves a little bit more here in the second segment. But I want to jump right into this, and I want to talk about photography in that era and this photo. And, George, why don't you start by explaining to the listeners, many of whom have only had digital cameras in their lives, what was the state of photography back then? What was film-based photography, for those who are far too young to understand? And what was photojournalism like in the 30s and 40s? Give us a heads up on that.
Well, sure. No, thank you, John, for that. I think most of us are familiar with film-based journalism, even people who are millennials or certainly way younger than Larry or I, and we've seen those films, a lot of them now captured on DVDs and Blu-ray that we watch. So that probably is something that most people are familiar with. But I think photojournalism is something that many of your listeners might not be that familiar with. I mean, most people define the the golden age of photojournalism from the 1930s to the early 1950s. That certainly encompassed all of World War II, and there are numerous iconic photographs from World War II, probably the most famous of which is this picture that we built the book around. But, I mean, some of the more well-known photojournalists back in the day were Romano Cagnoni, Alfred Eisenstadt, of course, Margaret Bourke White, and Eugene Smith, and then also Robert Capa. Some of the World War II photographers, in addition to Alfred Eisenstadt, Tony Vaccaro was a soldier who did that famous photo on the Omaha beach on D-Day. So I think it's fair to say World War II really spurred photojournalism to new heights, primarily because the war was such a massive undertaking and something that gripped every American, and for the people that weren't on the front, it was the way that they could see and understand the war. So I think that that golden age now percolates in pictures, of course, like the picture in our book, The Kissing Sailor, by Alfred Eisenstadt. It certainly percolates in the picture of the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima, which was on the cover of
everything.
So, Larry, over to you.
Yeah, and certainly Alfred Eisenstadt, I think, is the one that stands out amongst all of them, though he would defer to some of them himself, in fact, had in the past. But Alfred Eisenstadt, certainly the father of photojournalism, worked for Life magazine for a good part of his career. And I think has seen his signature photo, I think, which will be the topic of our discussion today, and certainly the topic of the Kissing Sailor book, you know, it came to epitomize an era that is really a turning point in history on many fronts. But that picture seems to be the pivotal moment, almost as if he's as if it was meant to be. So we're looking forward today to discuss that that photo and his contributions on that day.
Larry, how powerful could a single photo be? And I'm going to use a different photo as an example, but it's one that people are very familiar with, especially after the movie of a few years ago, Joe Rosenthal's famous shot of the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima. How influential was that in American policy and prosecuting of the war in the final months of World War II?
Well, we know that that photo resonated with the American people right from the get-go, and that had also its share of unknowns to go along with it, which was brought out in the movie. But I think in terms of it's interesting to see the link between that photo and the one that Eisenstadt took of the sailor kissing the nurse, in that there was actually a statue for the final, or I believe the second-to-last war bond drive of the of World War II that was actually in Times Square that day that Eisenstadt took that photo. In fact, Alfred Eisenstadt had to walk right by that statue, and the sailor was walking right towards that statue before he kissed the nurse. So a lot of people don't realize that in some way there was a connection there even back then at that point in time between those two photos.
Okay, I'm going to let you guys answer this question. Who was Alfred Eisenstadt? Where was he from? Where was he born? Why was he a photographer and photojournalist? And quite frankly, what kind of equipment did he use? What were the tools of his trade?
Well, I'll take a stab at that. For starters, Alfred Eisenstadt came to us from Germany. He actually served in World War I, where he barely made it out alive. Everyone in his unit was completely wiped out, but Alfred Eisenstadt was saved from that. He had an interest in photography prior to World War I, but that resumed later during the Great Depression as he was trying to make money selling belts for his for a local distributor to raise money for his family. But he never lost his love for the picture. And he began to, on an amateur status, to take photos and enter them into magazines, and all of a sudden started to build a name for himself. And he built such a name for himself after taking some actually fairly famous photos of Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, made his way over to the United States and was hired by an up-and-coming magazine, Life magazine, and started to serve on that celebrated staff. This, of course, led to August 14, 1945, when Alfred Eisenstadt was assigned to go out and get the picture that would epitomize the end of World War II. And even though that announcement had not been made at that point in time, in the afternoon of August 14, 1945, the announcement would not be made until 7 o'clock that evening to New Yorkers and the rest of the world. But word was out. The New Yorkers and the rest of the world knew that something big was coming, and they didn't wait to start their celebrating. So Alfred Eisenstadt walks out into Times Square, this wonderfully chaotic, jubilant arena where everyone's anticipating the end of World War II. And he's trying to find this picture, one which will make us feel what victory is all about. And he sees a sailor.
Okay, now, Larry, I'm going to stop you right there because I want to go and ask George, correct me if I'm wrong, George, you said you were a native New Yorker, correct?
Sure am, John. I mean, if you, George Galdorisi, it's about as Italian as it gets, and my grandfather was first generation American, immigrated from Italy, so I am a native New Yorker, proud of it.
Okay, well, tell us about Times Square. We all know what Times Square looks like today. We all tune in on New Year's Eve and see the big jumbotrons and signs and the mass of humanity. What was Times Square like then? The buildings obviously were there, but the presentation of media there was very different. And what was the news ticker? Talk to us a little bit. What was the place, the venue where this photo was taken?
Oh, yeah, and again, we talk about how, because it was so fascinating to us as part of the book, and we talk about in The Kissing Sailor, Times Square, and how it evolved to be what it came to be today. But more to the point, in 1945, it really was the crossroads of New York. And again, particularly for your younger listeners, John, there was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. There was no YouTube. And so if you really wanted to find out what was going on, you went to Times Square and you read the news on the famous ticker on the Time Life building. That was what the building was built to do. And so that was and it was also how, and we'll get to this later, Greta Zimmer Friedman happened to be in Times Square at that time. You went there to find out the truth. And as Larry mentioned earlier, there were many, many rumors circulating that day. So people went to Times Square to find out the truth from the ticker. Sounds pretty old-fashioned, but it was what it was.
Now, Larry, you talk about Eisenstadt being sent out to get the picture. I mean, let us not kid ourselves. At the time, Time magazine was arguably one of the most powerful publishing entities in the world. There, if we were trying to explain Life magazine at its heyday to young people today, it would be very hard to go and compare it to just Instagram or Flickr or a clipping place where you stick photos on a wall like Facebook. This was a weekly which was America and the world's view on itself, correct?
It was, and the mission of Life magazine was to show, where the mission of Time was to tell. In Life, it seemed that the photo trumped the word, and even though there were plenty of words, of course, to explain the photos, in the end, the photos were meant to stand by themselves and tell a story. In this oversized magazine with the extra-large pictures, oftentimes the photo would take up the entire page, and then there would be explanations and an article to follow in that. And that was the vehicle that, or the mechanism that Life used to show the world itself and to see itself as it never had before. And this was the magazine that Alfred Eisenstadt and other talented photographers worked for. They saw this as their mission. It wasn't just a job. They took everything very seriously, And when you look about somebody like Alfred Eisenstadt, you're talking about a photographer who had many interesting working habits. His idea was to get the picture without the subject knowing that he was taking their picture, even when the subject was aware of the photographer. Perhaps he was invited in to be there to take pictures. Alfred Eisenstadt would actually instruct his subjects, go about and do what you normally do. Let me worry about the picture. I don't exist. And he would make it a point to become insignificant in the scene, even when arranged ahead of time. And that's how he would get the picture, using only natural light, never using a flashbulb, always wanting it to be as natural and as spontaneous and real as possible, never posing photos.
We would call Heisenberg's law, that the act of observing an event changes the event.
It does, and he never wanted to alter that which would naturally be presented. That would be artificial, and what he was trying to do is capture the scene, and in this case, history as it happened.
And what kind of camera did he use? I mean, he had a particular brand and type of camera he used, and it would be a fair statement to say that despite the limitations of the gear and the film of the day, he definitely got the most out of it anybody could have.
I don't think anyone would challenge that. That is for sure. He was famous for using the Leica camera, and it was a on that particular day. He, according to his own notes, he had it focused where he could just turn and shoot, that he wouldn't have to actually focus the camera, that whatever presented itself would be there, because he wanted to capture the moment, and he anticipated that it would be a quick offering that would not allow for him to focus and make any of the adjustments that he might otherwise have the opportunity to do. So as he ran through the streets of Times Square, and he was, again, it's important to note that he was a very short man. He often brought this out. He referenced himself on several occasions as a midget, obviously making some humble humor at his own cost. But he would this enabled him to duck and bob and weave, as he would say, so that people could not see him. But when he saw this sailor moving, he was, as short as he was also very quick, and he was able to run ahead of the sailor to wait for the proper moment to present itself.
Okay, so he's, as you say, he's moving through a throng, for lack of a better term. People are there. They're sharing this atmosphere, and they're happy. War is coming to an end, the biggest war America's been in since the Civil War. And what does he see, and what draws his eye, and how does he take this picture?
Well, what he saw first, what he noticed initially, was a fast-moving sailor going through the crowds of Times Square. And in Times Square, the people are at this point are already all over the place. They're bumping into each other. They're starting to hug and jump up and down. And, again, anticipation of the news that many people feel is just a formality at that point in time. As far as they're concerned, World War II is over. This fast-moving sailor grabs Eisenstadt's attention. So he runs ahead of the sailor by several feet. We don't know exactly how many feet, but enough where he had some distance built up between he and the sailor. As he's running ahead and making a point to look over his shoulder, he all of a sudden sees something white being grabbed, is how he describes it. And he immediately turns around and sees the sailor that he assumes is the one he has been trying to keep track of, grabbing and kissing a nurse. It is at that point in time that he spins around and starts clicking the camera. And he doesn't click it just once. Many of us have seen just that one special photo, which was printed or published in Life magazine and has been republished hundreds of times over the last approximately 70 years. He actually has time to take four photos of the kiss, as well as another photographer who is on site, Lieutenant Victor Jorgensen, who takes another photo to Eisenstadt's right of the same exact scene. So this actually produces five very interesting photos of the same exact event, even though most people are only familiar with the singular photo.
Okay. Takes the shot, and it's over in a matter of maybe 30 seconds. Start to finish, from the time he sees this guy, takes the shots, and it's over. The engagement, 30 seconds, a minute tops. What happens then?
Well, I would say it was probably far less than 30 seconds. It was probably more, as best as we can determine, somewhere around 10 to 15 seconds. It's hard to come up with an exact timing of it. But if you, by judging by the movements of the people in the background over the four/five photos, you get a sense of passing time. So somewhere I would say close to 10 seconds is as best as I can determine it. With that being said, though, that's a fairly long kiss. The interesting thing is, as soon as the kiss is over, as soon as the sailor and the nurse part, and we reference her as a nurse for now, though we'll explain later a little bit more about her background. As soon as they part, the sailor goes on his way. The so-called nurse goes back to work, is what we know where she goes now, and Alfred Eisenstadt leaves the scene to seek another photo. He has no idea what he has just captured in terms of what it will become in history. He fails to take any notes of the encounter. In fact, a reporter that was with him in Times Square is separated from him at that very moment in time. So what we have left after this is a sailor leaving the scene. We do not know his name. We don't know anything about him other than that he apparently is a sailor. We have a woman leaving the scene who we assume to be a nurse, and we know that, in fact, Alfred Eisenstadt has taken a photo and gone off on his route to find another subject to take a picture of. And what we are left with is this gem, this gift of the time, so to speak, for us to look at forever and ever. But what we don't know is the background of the picture or who, in fact, is in the picture.
Okay. Now, George, let's go and talk a little technology here. He has taken this picture. Actually, he's taken probably a couple of rolls of pictures, and he returns back to the Time Life Building. What happens over the next few hours? What have you folks been? What have you two been able to discern? Is the process that follows this?
Well, I'll start it out and then kick it over to Larry, who's had wonderful conversations with Bobby Baker Burrows and other people at Life Magazine. But what he did is what photojournalists did when they're taking photos. He took approximately 3.5 dozen photos that day, and he put them, including these four photos of the sailor and nurse, he just put them in the night slot of Life Magazine. As he was instructed to do, and he always did, and he went home his business. I suspect he started his celebration along with everyone else in the country at that point. And then what we've learned from talking to these folks, the next day, and as Larry mentioned, he went off to find more photos. The next day he got a call from the editor at Life Magazine and just exclaiming, "Alfred, this photograph is fabulous. It's wonderful. You know, great job." And his words were, "What photo?" It didn't strike him at the moment that this captured the moment of triumph any better than any other one. So that was the general process. And I'll turn it over to Larry, as I said, who's spoken more with people at Life and has a more well-nuanced view of this than I do.
Yeah, I mean, just to piggyback on exactly what George just said, he had to be reminded about what photo they were referring to. In fact, as he said, I had no idea what photo they were talking about. This was a photo that he took in the hopes of capturing the picture, but he took many photos that day. The editors did look over the rolls of film, and most of them were uninteresting. This one stood out far beyond the rest. And I've seen some of those photos, and they are uninteresting. They don't entice you at all. This one is the gem. But he didn't realize just how special it was. In fact, even when he saw it, he was he critiqued his own work, thinking that that there are things that could have been perhaps more intriguing, more from an artist's point of view of the photo. Some things that perhaps he could have done better, cropped it in better. The lighting could have been different. The angle could have been different. There were things that he critiqued of his own work, not realizing that that this was a gift for the ages, for many years to come. The photo itself appeared 2 weeks later in Life magazine. It was not on the cover, as many people assume, or in fact, I've heard many sources state that, when in fact the photo never appeared on the cover of Life magazine throughout the entire magazine's history. It did appear on some reprint magazines, but never on the originals from Life magazine. This one appeared on page 27. It was a full, full page presentation, and it was nondescript. It says a sailor basically kissing a nurse. That's basically all it said. But Life magazine knew they had something special. A year later, in 1946, they reprinted the photo in their 10th year anniversary, where they selected the best photos of the first 10 years. And right there, it escapes me what page it was, but again, a full-length photo with a different caption this time, but again, no name, of the same photo. Life would then go on to reprint it at three or four other times over its the rest of its history, and the photo gained popularity and interest as the years went on.
Okay, and today we know it as a truly iconic photo that defines a moment in time, not just for the United States, but for the world. And I'm going to leave it right there because I want to talk now about how you discovered the story of this photo and at the same time how George discovered this photo and the story behind it. And oh, by the way, how you two discovered each other and wrote a book about it. So I know that, Larry, you were involved with it as a history teacher. You liked using photos to go and stimulate your students in school. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. It was actually in 1994, well before PowerPoint was a part of a tool that a teacher might use in a classroom. At least it was certainly well before I was using it. What I would do is actually make slides of still photos and then project them onto the screen. This was pretty cutting edge for 1994. But that's how I would teach a lot of subjects, especially World War II. And in February of 1994, I was finishing up a unit on World War II, and I was showing some of the, famous images, including the mushroom cloud over Hiroshima, and talking about what that was and some of the controversy behind it. And shortly after that was the photo which I used to end World War II, and that was Eisenstadt's famous photograph. At that point in time, I said in that classroom, this is an anonymous sailor kissing an anonymous nurse, but it captures the moment like no other photo has ever captured the end of a war. And you just can kind of get a sense of how people were feeling at that point in time that this war was over. Well, no sooner did I finish that great declaration where a student in the back of the classroom, now this student was at best, an average student, wonderful young man. I still know him to this day. Love him to death. But he was a challenge to teach, and he was a cut up sort. And he raises his hand from the back of the classroom. I still remember his desk leaning back a little bit against the wall, and he says, "Oh, Mr. Veria." And I said, "Yes, Anthony." And he says, "I know that guy." And no sooner does he say it, everybody in the classroom starts to laugh because they assume, as did I, that this was yet another moment for him to redirect the class in a direction that he wanted to take it. And what was funny about this is I was teaching in an open classroom forum, so there were students in other classes, like a math class, an English class, and a history class, if I recall correctly, and they could hear the conversation going back and forth where I said, "Anthony, you can't possibly know who's in this photo. This no one knows in this photo." And he kept claiming, "No, I do. I have breakfast with him on Saturday mornings. He's a fisherman." And the story got more and more involved, and as it did, you could hear students in the other classrooms starting to laugh. Well, finally that day ended, and I didn't really think much of what Anthony had said other than that he had gotten me off track once again. About a year later, I'm walking through Newport with my wife, and we go by this restaurant, a small diner called the Handy Lunch, and I noticed the picture of the kissing sailor outside. And it gave me pause. I remembered what my student had said a year earlier. It came back into my mind. It wasn't that I had thought about it much. It just brought it back. So I went in and talked to the waitress, and I said, I noticed you had that photo there. I said, why is that? And she says, well, that's George Mendoza. He's the kissing sailor. And I said, what do you mean? Who's George Mendoza? And she says, well, he's a fisherman right here in town of Newport. And I said, oh, so this is like a local legend kind of thing. She says, no, we honestly think he's the one. So she says, in fact, if you go across the street and go down that alleyway, down to the docks, he's probably down there fishing as we speak, or you know, his boat might be in as we speak. So I took that as that's enough of a calling for me to go down and meet this man who claims to be the man in the photo. And he was a fascinating guy. When I finally ran into him, he was very colorful. I remember walking away thinking, oh, I'm not so sure about this. But I actually did take the time to go and visit him at his home at his invitation, and he laid out all the evidence, and I thought it was convincing. Didn't know what to make of it, but I thanked him, and that was pretty much the end of it, so I thought. Years later, I learned about all of these other people who had come forward to claim to be the kissing sailor, and I was curious, and I remembered my conversations with George Mendoza, and I wondered, and I said, you know, someday as a history teacher, that's going to be my contribution to history, is to really figure this thing out. Who was in that photo, and then really know the story behind this wonderful picture. Fast forward to 2007, again in the fall, the winter of 2007, I was telling about the story of the kissing sailor, and a young girl came into the classroom who was sitting, in the back of the classroom, and she said, Staveria, I know of whom you speak, and I hate to tell you, but he passed away. And it gave me great pause at that moment. I thought that, you know, we had lost potentially someone very special who never had an opportunity to truly share his story. And I had promised myself I was going to do something about it and never had. Well, the very next day, she comes running into my classroom, all excited, animated, and says, Mr. Veria, he's alive. I got it all wrong. Well, at that point in time, I said, you know, I've waited long enough. I'm going to figure this thing out. So I went to visit Mr. Mendoza shortly afterwards, and I said, you know, I'm going to try to figure this thing out. I don't know, frankly, if it's you. It might be someone else, but wherever the evidence takes me, I'm going to tell the world that story, and I want us once and for all to know who it is, because whoever it is deserves the recognition that up to this point in time, no one seems to truly be able to get. And that's where I started in earnest in 2007, giving basically the next 4 to 5 years of my life over to trying to figure this thing out and tell the story.
Now, before you go any further, I'd like to go over to George and ask him the same question, because at some point you two are going to get together. So, George, you're still with us, sir.
Yeah, John, so thanks. So I think Larry teed it up beautifully, and I'll just pile on. And I guess, you know, as a sort of an intro to this, and for people who want to write a book, you know, you have this vision of, you know, being up on the third floor Warren and thinking of all these great ideas. I think as Larry started, and I'll pile on, this book happened to us. We didn't think of it in our you know, study one day. So I was visiting a friend in Middleton, Rhode Island, Jerry O'Donnell. And to answer your question directly, John, there's no other person who has more ownership in this book than retired Navy Captain Jerry O'Donnell. Visiting Jerry, had dinner with he and his wife, and we've been good friends since our Navy days. And after dinner, Jerry says, hey, I want you to meet my next-door neighbor. Now, I have to confess, John, I'm a New Yorker, and my wife, Becky, who's from the South, will tell you I'm not the most social person. So initially I sort of asked myself, well, why do I want to meet his next-door neighbor? So we go next door. We're met at the door by this woman, Rita, and we walk down into the lower level study, and there is George Mendoza. The study looked like a World War II museum. George was in his 70s then, and you don't have a 10-minute conversation with anyone that age. So we talked for probably several hours. He told me the whole story. He signed a picture of the photo. I showed my wife. I showed my kids. I showed my coworkers. Put it on my shelf, and it was a nice event. But that was it. And then about a year later, I got a call from from Jerry O'Donnell, and he said, hey, I've got this other friend, Larry, and he has done what Larry just described to you, John. He's written 80,000 words that describe this event and prove that George is a sailor, but he doesn't have an agent, so he can't get a publisher, and he doesn't have a publisher, so he can't get an agent, and he thought maybe you could help him. So we had a nice conversation. I was impressed by Larry's contagious enthusiasm, and I found an agent I knew. I put them together. I figured I'd done God's work, and off they went to write a book, and I figured I'd get to read it someday. So about, I don't know, maybe a year later, I was having a conversation with Jerry, and I said, hey, how's your friend Larry doing with that book? And he said, oh, man, it's awful. This agent wasn't much help. In fact, she tried to get him to turn it into a novel, and that's not going to work, and so he's kind of stuck. So, you know, I said, well, give him my contact data, and Larry and I talked, and one thing led to another, and we decided to collaborate on this, and yeah, I think the rest is kind of history, as they say.
Now, George, there is a little subplot here, and you'll be pleased to know I confirmed this with no less than Norman Pollmar, our mutual friend and the grand dean of naval writers in this country, that not just he, but a number of other people said, oh, that's a cute little story, but it's not a book. It's an article. Talk about that, and shall we say, not necessarily the discouragement, but the challenge that those people placed in front of both of you to turn this into a viable story that was worthy of a book.
Oh, no. Well, thanks for that. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, and if there's a sub-subplot.
By the way, Norman says hello to both of you for it.
Thank you for that, John. No, if there's a sub-subplot in any kind of writing, whether it's a book or an article or something for your high school yearbook, you've got to be persistent. So when Larry and I decided to team up, I did have an agent, John Silbersack at Trident Media Group, and as you mentioned, John, Norman Pollmar is a fantastic writer and mentor to me. The first person I called about it was Norman. I said, hey, Norman, I've talked with this guy Larry, and we've got this great idea for a book. And he said, George, it's an article about a book. And, you know, Norman's a smart guy and pretty persistent, so he said that, and I said, well, you know, thanks. And I was a little discouraged. But then I next called my agent, John Silbersack, who eventually would shop the proposal for us, and said, hey, John, you know, here's this great idea. And his exact words were, it's an article, not a book. So that was strike two. So like in baseball, I didn't want to strike out, but I kept trying. And I called a gentleman named Stephen Power, who had been my editor at Avon for my first two novels. And Stephen liked the idea, and he thought it was a fabulous idea. And, in fact, he gave us the idea. He said, you know, it's more than just the proof. And we talked a while, and we noodled a while. He said, it's really the five P's. It's the picture, it's the place, Times Square, which we talked about a little earlier in the show, John. It's the publication, Life Magazine, which was the iconic publication at that time. It's the people and their very fascinating lives, irregardless of the picture. And then it's the proof, and package it that way. So he said, I'm going to take this to my editorial board. And at that time, Stephen worked for John Wiley Publishers, which is a good a nonfiction house, and he took it to his board, and he called me up, and he said, they think it's an article, not a book. So,
now, in the interest of full disclosure to our audience, I need to say, not only have I written my own book with Mr. Pollmar, but the last two books I did with Dwight Zimmerman as my co-author, Stephen Power was my editor at Wiley. So we're talking a very, very small and talented world of people who are all involved in this kind of writing. So please continue.
Yeah, well, so eventually we were able to talk with the Naval Institute, and they liked the idea, and they agreed to publish the book. And I think in retrospect, that's probably the best possible publisher, just due to number one, their reputation and their credibility for history and setting the historical record straight. So, like I said, we were blessed with good editors at Proceedings. So they made the book happen.
And Larry, obviously you started with the 80,000 words earlier referenced by George. How much of that original word count survived, and what were the major alterations that you guys had to make in terms of direction and focus with the book on the way to actually publishing it with Naval Institute Press?
Well, first of all, I mean, it was a gift to have George on board with the book. He's a talented writer, and the Kissing Sailor would not be as good of a book if it were not for his contributions. There's certainly no doubt about that. And I think the thing that George did, and he did several things, obviously, but the thing that really stands out for me is the need to streamline, to stay to the story at hand. There's so much information, and this is, I think, true of anyone who writes a book. You can go on for, you know, 80,000 words, 100,000 words, 120,000 words. I mean, just keep going on and on and on. The point is, where do you bring that in, and how can you focus that for the reader so that that you're keeping them with you? There's no sense in going off on sidebars if no one's joining you for that journey. So, among the many things that I think that changed in the book were among those things was to streamline the message, but also. You know, just to go through chapter by chapter with George and say, you know, what are we saying here? What do we want the reader to take home with this? It was a great experience. And in addition to that, and a real appreciation, this is where George and I were very much on the same page, I think, despite these very qualified opinions about it, the work being a magazine article, is that there are layers here. There are layers along the five principles that George spoke to, but there are many, you know, subplots to the story. There's so many other people who came forward. What were their stories? Why is it not them and not this man? And what did he have to go through? What's it been like for the two people in this photo to say, you know, that's me, and I have a story to share, and I want to share it, but first I need to be proven that I am, in fact, who I say I am. And this is the mission of this book, is not just simply to prove who's in the photo, but as George mentioned earlier, to then now to tell the story behind that photo. And so I think to work together and to have Jerry O'Donnell, our mutual friend, see that teamwork would work, that we could both bring something to this that would finally let the truth be known.
And what actually, according to more than a few people, including Mr. Pulmar, what makes this work is, in fact, that you answered the question, the who. Who are these people? Because as we're about to go and talk about, this was not a clear issue, and there were, in fact, a number of individuals and couple pairings who either claimed to have been there and kissed. And there was more than a little bit of confusion. And, in fact, this became highlighted this past week when one of the better-known claimants passed away. So let's talk about the question of who thought they were the subject of Eisenstadt's photo. And I'm going to let you guys figure out and tag-team how to tell this story. Go for it, guys.
Well, I'm a New Yorker, so I'll blurt out first, but I want Larry to tell most of this if he would. But I did want to pick up on your point about why this photo is so unique, John. And I think the other, if you want to call it a hook for this book, is those three people should not have been there. They should have been dead. As Larry said, Alfred Eisenstadt was a German soldier in World War II. His unit was wiped out in a battle. He had been wounded several days before, so he was in a field hospital. He was spared. So he shouldn't have been there in the first place in Times Square. Greta Zimmer Friedman happened to be of the Jewish faith tradition, living in Austria. In 1939, if you were of the Jewish faith, Austria was not a happy place to be. And imagine this as a parent. Her parents made the fateful decision to put Greta and her sister on a boat to live with relatives in New York, and regrettably, the rest of Greta's family perished in the Holocaust. So she shouldn't have been there. And then George Mendoza, World War II sailor, all of the big battles, Lady Gulf, Coral Sea, et cetera, but probably most prominently, he was in the USS Sullivan's, the ship named for the famous Sullivan brothers who perished in the war. During he was part of Admiral Halsey's Task Force 38.2, and that task force famously was caught by Typhoon Cobra. Several ships were sunk. Over 700 sailors died. George happened to be the helmsman of the Sullivans during that storm, so he was spared too. So we think the cool thing, it's so remarkable the three of them were there in the first place. So with that, I'll pass the mic over to Larry.
Yeah, not only was it amazing that those three were there, but there were so many others there in Times Square as well, and some of them have, you know, very interesting stories as well. The problem that this, of course, presents is that there were many young sailors in Times Square that day who kissed women, many of them who were dressed in white.
And it's safe to say, on the last day of the greatest war of their generation, as you say, there were going to be a bunch of sailors there, and let's not kid ourselves, there was probably a lot of kissing and massive foreplay going on. I mean, 9 months later, there had to be the beginnings of a baby boom out of the people who were in that square that day.
You know, it's interesting you put it that way too, John, because a lot of people see this photo as one of romance or lust or something in that family. And as it turns out, we'll speak to this a little bit later, it was neither of the two. But what we do have is a lot of sailors who remember kissing that nurse in Times Square, and their picture was taken. And this is something we're adamant about. They're not lying. They do see themselves in that photo. We understand that fully. The problem is that the evidence doesn't lead to supporting their claim. But that doesn't stop a revolving door of people coming forward and having their day of being the kissing sailor. As early as 1980, Edith Shane, now obviously a woman, claimed to be the nurse, and Alfred Eisenstadt basically crowned her as the nurse, went out to meet her and said, yes, you're the one who I took the photo of. We argue that that's virtually impossible, but nonetheless, once she was named the nurse, she became the nurse forever and ever. Shortly after that, on Good Morning America, they had Edith Shane, the nurse, with Alfred Eisenstadt, and they were interviewing the two of them. At that point in time, Alfred Eisenstadt said he now knew who the sailor was, and he named in 1980 Bill Swicegood as the sailor, who enjoyed early on in the 1980s the name as the kissing sailor. That was challenged many times over throughout the 1980s and 1990s. In 1985, Ted Koppel came out and basically named Marvin Kingsbury as the kissing sailor. And that was owing largely to a documentary done called 4585 with Peter Jennings. And so the whole world basically saw Marvin Kingsbury as the kissing sailor. In 1986, Jim Reynolds comes forward as the kissing sailor, according to Pastor George Byron Koch. And what he had said was that that picture was taken on VE Day, that Life magazine, in essence, had lied. It wasn't VJ Day. They had grabbed it from earlier files. That story took on a conspiracy angle kind of thing, which people love, and that, to this very day, still gets quoted. In 1995, Carl Muscarello was named the kissing sailor by Edith Shane, the nurse that Alfred Eisenstadt had named in 1980. She said, I have finally found my sailor. It's not Swicegood. It's not Kingsbury. It is Carl Muscarello. And he became the kissing sailor. Chris Palmer, who basically was an expert on Life magazine and sold the magazine and became very curious about this around the year 2000, and he determined that it was a man by the name of Ken McNeil and actually put together a very extensive website on proving that it was Ken McNeil. Then finally in 2007, Lois Gibson, the famous forensic artist in Houston, Texas, determined that it was Glenn McDuffie, who just passed away and has been getting an awful lot of attention in the last few days, after the fact, obviously. But nonetheless, Diane Sawyer caught on to that, and Good Morning America introduced him as the kissing sailor. So what we've seen over the years is several people coming forward with main celebrity-type spokespeople to basically say that we now finally have the kissing sailor, when in fact none of those people are the kissing sailor, and Ida Shane is not the nurse in the photo.
Now, this is not necessarily out of malice or avarice for publicity. These people probably believe they were the people because they probably kissed someone who looked like a nurse or were a nurse who got kissed by a sailor that day in Times Square, right?
Now,
I would agree fully with that.
George, you're spot on. Again, I think what got this started is in 1980, Life magazine said, you know, it's been 35 years since the end of the war. We're going to do a retrospective issue on the war. This is our far and away our most famous photograph. Wouldn't it be cool if we knew who the people are? Would the real sailor raise your hand? And as Larry indicated, Edith Shane had already convinced Alfred Eisenstadt that she was the nurse. So Life magazine only asked for the sailor to raise his hand, but lots of people, sailors and nurses, came forward raising their hand. And as you suggested, John, these people weren't charlatans. First of all, in talking with George Mendonza, who we'll talk about this, I suspect, later, but he made his way from Radio City Music Hall to Times Square via Child's Bar. And in George's words, he said, I pounded down a few because if you were a sailor, you could not buy a drink. So you have a lot of people, and maybe in one stage of jolliness or the other, kissing somebody. And 35 years later, things are a little hazy. You can look at that picture legitimately and say, "Yeah, that was me." So, yeah, I think the point is well taken. These people, we think most of them were sincere in their belief that they were the ones. So, Larry, over to you.
No, I couldn't agree more, and this is a position that we make very, very clear in the book. In fact, the only reason that we took on their cases, because we did present their cases exactly as I think they would have presented them if they were writing the book themselves, but then we had to then revisit their case and say, look, this is why it really can't be them. And so we had to take apart their case piece by piece. That, frankly, didn't feel good, because that was not the intent of the book. The book was to give recognition to the person who deserved it, but to not address these cases, even from people who believed in their heart of hearts that they were the person in the photo, was to leave the door open that, well, what about this other person? What about this other person? So we felt that we needed to address all of these people in the book.
Now, let me just say real quickly to our listeners, this book lays out in excellent detail the efforts that Larry and George made in running down each of the stories of each of the individuals, and, oh, by the way, each of the possible combinations, because it's not just individuals, it's combination possibilities that are not entirely clear at times as well. And that all said, gentlemen, explain who you think and who you have positive proof you believe the kissing sailor and the lady are.
Well, I think, you know, it's the evidence speaks loudly. It is George Mendoza from Middletown, Rhode Island, originally from Newport, Rhode Island, and Greta Friedman, as George Galderisi had mentioned earlier, originally from Austria. She was not a nurse. She was a dental assistant who heard all kinds of stories that day that the war was coming to an end, and she desperately wanted the war to end. She wanted to be reunited with her family, not realizing that that would not be possible any longer. But on August 14th, 1945, hope still was in her heart. And when she heard the end of World War II was finally upon us, she could not contain herself anymore. During her lunch break in the late afternoon, she took off to Times Square to find out if indeed it was all true, to read the zipper, as she would call it, to see if it was true that the war had ended. And that's where she was when George Mendoza found her.
And what is it about their stories and the details in the photo, and not just the photo, but the other four photos that were taken, as well as archival film, other pictures, and the accounts. What are the compelling bits of evidence that make you think that it is Mr. Mendoza and Ms. Friedman?
Well, as George and I would agree, there's no one thing. There is an accumulation of many things. What we did is we looked over some of the evidence which had been collected prior or produced prior to our study. In 1985, Richard Benson, a photo expert at Yale University, examined the photo to find out if it was George Mendoza in the photo, as George Mendoza had claimed. And he found something that I think is, to this day, very compelling. He found on the left arm, and he used the fourth picture of Eisenstadt, not the famous one. There were four photos taken again. He used the fourth one because that was the one that was clearest, as it turns out. It's not as interesting, but it is the clearest. And what he noticed on the left arm was a cyst or a bump or a wen, as it is sometimes referenced. And he found this very interesting, and he wondered if that would be on George Mendoza's arm. So he went to see George Mendoza after examining the photo. Again, he saw it first in the fourth photo of Eisenstadt's four photos. And he asked George to see his left arm, and George said, "You mean my right arm? That's the one you can really see in the picture best." He says, "No, I want to see your left arm. I want you to roll up your sleeve, and I want you to turn your arm the way the sailor has it in the photo." And George Mendoza did that. And what George, when George did that, he had no idea why he was being asked to do this. You can see the bump exactly where it is in the photo. No other candidate who has ever come forward has been able to make a claim to that same bump in the photo, specifically the fourth photo, because that is the one that you see it clearest in. In addition to that, there are other markings all over his body and arm, his face. Some of these came out in other studies. In 1995, Mitsubishi Engineering Research Lab actually did a study. This is a lab that typically uses their technology to de-age adults back to when they were a child, to create a look-alike of what they would look like as a child to see if they were abducted when they were younger. They decided to turn this technology to historical purposes to see if they de-aged George Mendoza, the claimant kissing sailor, would he look like the sailor in the photo? And when they did that, they digitally created a mask, and this is done by taking literally thousands of photos of George Mendoza and getting the contour of his face, and then using what they did know to be images of him as a younger age, and create a George Mendoza 1945 mask. And then what they did is they superimposed that mask onto the kissing sailor photo, Eisenstadt's famous photo, to see if it would, as they said, fit. And when they did that, they found it to be a perfect fit, meaning the contour of the cheek, the nose, the chin, it was all the same. Finally, in 2010, we contacted Dr. Norman Sauer from Michigan State University Forensic Anthropology Department. And I asked him if he would agree, and the reason I had selected him was because his name kept coming up. I contacted forensic anthropologists all over the country, and I said, this is what I'm doing. I'm working with photos. And most of them said, you know, if you don't have the artifact, the actual bone structure, the skull, so to speak, for us to work with, then that's not our expertise. But they kept mentioning Dr. Norman Sauer. So I tried to contact him, and he got back, and I told him what I was doing, and I started to tell him the story behind it, and he stopped me literally mid-sentence and said, I don't want to talk about your story. He says, I got what you're trying to do. He says, send all the information to me for George Mendoza, but also the others, and I will study this over the next several months, and I will get back to you, and I will tell you who is in your photo, if indeed George Mendoza, or if it is someone else. And that's where we left it. He contacted me several months later and said, okay, we've done our study, and he started to talk about some of the differences with the other people. And I said, well, what about George Mendoza? Did you find similarities with George Mendoza? And he said, yes. And he said it in such a way where it was not very impressive. And I said, that doesn't seem that important somehow, the way you've just said that. And he says, because it's not important. And I was a little confused by that. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you can have similarities between people, that are different. In other words, two different people could have the same shaped nose, and it'd be very difficult to distinguish it. We don't really look for similarities. We can spot similarities, but what we're really looking for are differences. And can we find any differences in the shape of the cheek, the nose, the ear, the arm, anything that we could therefore take George Mendoza off the list? And what they determined was that they couldn't find one single inconsistency between George Mendoza and the photo of the kissing sailor, where the other candidates, including Glenn McDuffie, who they found the very easiest to remove from consideration because there were so many differences, they were able to find many differences between those candidates and the kissing sailor himself. With
George,
all of that information...
quick question. You know, you're a naval aviator. You're a professional flyer, and you obviously have superior eye-hand perception and coordination. When you look at the photo and you look at George Mendoza as well as Ms. Friedman, do you see them fitting the way they do in the photo as human beings, how they fit together?
Not to put too fine a point on it, John, but I bet my mortgage payment that these are the people. I mean, it just makes sense. And I think, as Larry indicated, let's say there weren't any other people coming forward besides George and Greta. Looking at the size of them, looking at the other indicators, not even looking at the proofs, the various proofs that Larry just mentioned, it makes complete sense to me. And I think that in and of itself would be enough for me, probably when I was flying helicopters. But not to tell you too much, now I work at a Navy lab where analysis is what we do, and we're trained and taught to look at things more carefully. So now looking at the proofs, number one, and number two, the strong indicators, as Larry mentioned, that the other people can't be it. It just rejects their cases, however passionate they are. It does prove it. And again, not to get off track, but I mean, I think that captures the main reason we wrote the book. It was important to us that George and Greta would be recognized as these people, and their children and their grandchildren and their extended families would know they are the ones. They're both 90 years old, and unfortunately they won't be with us forever, so it was important to us to get the book done while they're alive. So that was the fun thing.
Guys, here's a question for you, and I don't know the answer to it, so I'm going to just throw that one out there, and I'm not supposed to do that in radio because you're always supposed to know the answer to every question you ask. Have George and Greta met since that time, and at any point did Eisenstadt meet either of them after the photo was taken?
Yes, they have met several times since then. First in 1980, and that was actually with Alfred Eisenstadt. And they are good friends to this very day, going forward.
Okay, and what happened to these three people after August 14th, 1945? I mean, we all know Eisenstadt went on, and today is revered as one of the, you know, literally the founding fathers of modern media and photojournalism. But what happened to him, and what happened to George and Greta? Where are they all? What happened to them, and where are they today?
Well, they've spent a large part of the last 30-plus years trying to gain their due, their recognition for being in that photo. That photo means something to them. They know it means something to lots of people all over this world, not only in the United States. They want the proper story to be told, their part in that story to be told. And it has been basically a long fight, not only with Life magazine, but with trying to convince others that they are, in fact, in that photo. That has been a large part of, I know, certainly George Mendoza's life, less so Greta Friedman, but more so George Mendoza's life going forward from that time, from 1980 specifically. In between 1945 and 1980, he did what most Americans did after World War II. They raised a family, worked hard, paid their bills, and were quite surprised to learn in 1980 that they were in that he was in the most famous photo, one of the most famous photos of all time. But in, you know, to cut down a life that quickly in terms of what they've been doing, that's basically the progression of events.
And looking at them, they really are representative of what Tom Brokaw once dubbed the greatest generation, are they not?
No, I would certainly agree with that. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They epitomize it in many respects. I think the sad part of that is that they're not that they've had to fight so long for their recognition. And we're hoping that, and we know that the book makes a strong enough case to really remove all doubt as to who is in fact in that photo. If I may, I want to make sure that we added this. I think it's important for your listeners to hear this. George Mendoza, the reason when he was coming down Times Square, the reason he decided to kiss this nurse is an interesting story. He was actually with a date on that day, and she actually appears in the background of the very first of Eisenstadt's picture. You really can't see her very well in any of the other pictures, but the first of Eisenstadt's four photos you can. And the question becomes, obviously, well, why are you kissing another woman when you have this date? And this requires us to go back to World War II very quickly. When the Bunker Hill was struck by kamikazes in May of 1945, the Sullivans came up along shortly afterwards to actually gather up many sailors who were escaping a burning Bunker Hill, trying to save their own lives. And the Sullivans picked up many of these sailors. And as George Mendoza said, they were in a bad way. And when he tells this story, it becomes very emotional, as many, obviously, World War II veterans do when recounting a traumatic experience from the war. And shortly after rounding them up, and we're talking rounding them up by the scores, they transferred these sailors to a nurse ship called the USS Bountiful. And George Mendoza, the helmsman of the Sullivans, was looking over the scene of the transfer of the sailors, and he saw the nurses going to work on those sailors, as he said. And you might think a sailor out at sea, away from the mainland for so long, would see these women in a way that, you know, of a different interest. But what he actually saw was the maternal care that these nurses provided for these sailors who were in a bad way, and he never forgot what he saw. And it was kind of one of those freeze frame moments in the war where he was reminded of what we were fighting for. Fast forward to Times Square in 1945. He left Child's Bar in Times Square, as George Galderisi had said earlier, and he's marching down Times Square. He's feeling good about the war being over. He's feeling good about the day, the moment, and he sees the nurse. And in that frame of mind, it brings him back to that moment and the joy that we got through this. We made it through. And all of a sudden, that nurse is not an individual. She represents something much larger than that. And he kisses
her. She's an angel. She's literally an angel.
That's actually a very good way of putting that. And that's exactly what he sees her as. So when people see this photo, they say, oh, this is a sailor, you know, taking the opportunity to kiss a pretty nurse, when at some level I suppose it's that, but it's much more than that when we know the story of why he actually would take the time to do that when he has a girlfriend right with him. Once that's over, it's over. It was almost like it was a moment that was meant to be, and off he goes. As he's been asked many years since then, well, What did you think of? He said, well, it meant nothing to me. I wasn't doing it for any other reason. In fact, that's something I never would have attempted ever at any other time in my life. He said it was just that moment with that news under those circumstances, remembering that particular scene, that I in essence, could not help myself. And that's why he kissed the nurse.
George, quick question. How is this book doing? Because it seems to be growing in terms of sales as a bit of a groundswell as the story of these two people and Eisenstadt are retold. How is this book selling these days, and how are the folks at Naval Institute doing pushing it out there for you?
Well, no, thanks for asking, John. The book's been out now almost 2 years. Naval Institute Did a good print run. If I recall, the book is in its fourth or fifth printing. It's done quite well. We've been able, and again, the folks at Naval Institute, who you know so well, did a wonderful job with publicity. I think one of the key helpers to that is the gentleman who was kind enough to write the foreword to the book and is much more involved in the book than anyone who would normally just write a foreword to be friendly. David Hartman was on The View talking about the book, and it got that show got rave reviews. So the book is doing quite well. I think Naval Institute is pleased with it. They expect it to have a long print run. So I think that's all good. But I did, if you don't mind, want to pile on to something that Larry said about the moment in Times Square. I think what most people forget is there was all this jubilation about the end of the war, and that in and of itself would have been great. And as we talked about earlier, I think if you bookended these two photos, the famous Rosenberg Joe Rosenberg photo of the raising the flag at Iwo Jima, when you look at that photo, you knew what it was like to fight and die in World War II. You could feel it. It became emotional. When you look at this picture, you know what it felt like when the war ended. But again, it's more than the war ending. The other thing, after by Japan surrendering, we didn't have to invade Japan. And anyone who knows a little bit about history knows that some of the statistics of the predicted casualties invading Japan were in the hundreds of thousands. So it wasn't just relief that the war was over. It was that we weren't going to have to start what was likely to be the bloodiest part of the war. So I think that's, just one way to kind of understand the emotion of the moment.
I'd like to finish up the show today by talking back again to Larry. Larry, next year is going to be the 70th anniversary of this photo. And, of course, we are shortly going to begin the celebration of the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. It'll obviously begin in August. What is the long-term legacy of this photo? And yes, it's a bookend. Yes, it's a snapshot of emotion and a lot of other things. But in your mind, what is the legacy of this photo, and how does it help the world understand what was happening at that moment?
Well, I do think that, a lot of people I've heard say, in a few years, this photo will be a part of history itself. And I like to correct them when they say that, because, my daughter went to Simmons College, and she was there not a week, and I heard from her, and she says, "Dad, that photo," she was referring to, obviously, the photo of the kissing sailor, she says, "it's in all my friends' bedrooms. They have it up in their rooms. It's a photo that means so much to so many people. It certainly will always capture for me and any informed viewer the end of World War II." And I think that's we never want to forget that. At the same time, I think it resonates for all kinds of reasons when people see that photo. I don't think there's ever been a time that I've used it in the classroom that people didn't want to know the story. What's the story behind the photo? And for years, we couldn't tell that story because we just didn't know enough about it. We only knew that where it took place and the time period. And that was a lot, but it wasn't enough. We are now in a position to finally tell the whole story. And I think what's important to note here is that the fear that I might have had at the beginning of all of this is, what if I don't like the story behind the photo? What if it takes something away from the photo? And I think that's always a risk with the truth, that the truth doesn't fit neatly into your storyline. In this case, I think the story behind the photo is of the sort that you can't make up. I couldn't have created it better if I had tried. That's the magic of this photo as well. I think it is worthy, as it turns out, of the iconic image. There is a wonderful photo, but there is also a wonderful story about two people, as George Gallerisi pointed out, who defied all the odds, who crossed paths on the day the world's greatest war came to an end and captured for us, with the help of the great photographer Eisenstadt, who survived World War I somehow, what it feels like for war finally to come to an end. I think that's timeless. I don't know that ever grows old. The 70th anniversary, the 100th anniversary, the 500th anniversary of the end of World War II, I think we'll still be talking about Eisenstadt's picture of George Mendoza and Greta Friedman.
George, how important is context in understanding an event and a vision like this?
Well, I mean, I think in this case, context is everything. Think about it. If that photo, if a sailor happened to be kissing a nurse in Times Square just randomly 5 days before the end of the war, it wouldn't have meant anything to anybody, and I don't think it would have had the fame it did. So I think that, you know, the context, if Alfred Eisenstadt, as Larry indicated earlier, was sent out, he was the father of photojournalism. He was Life magazine stud. They sent him out in Times Square to get the photo, and so I think, you know, it took a while for everyone to really embrace this photo and become so famous, as Larry indicated, that it's on college dorm walls of people who, you know, have all World War II is to them as a history lesson. So I think the context made the photo what it is.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming on today. I want to thank you for giving us a great story to tell today on Military Monday. And I hope someday we can talk about another book that you two collaborate on, or another story that you take the time to dig into deep. Again, thanks for coming.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you, John. We enjoyed being with you for this time.
You're very welcome, gentlemen, and have a great afternoon. I'd like to close the show today by remembering a friend. This past week, America lost another one of its greatest generation people. His name was Lee Mize. You probably never heard of Lee Mize. Lee was a Korean War era veteran and Vietnam. He was a Medal of Honor recipient, won that in the Korean War. He was actually nominated for another one during Vietnam, but was denied that by the Army bureaucracy and politics of the day. Lee was a legendary, legendary individual, especially in the Army Special Forces. As a Green Beret, he was one of the toughest guys you'd ever meet and one of the best. I had the pleasure of knowing Lee Mize for a few years, and this amazing American always treated me with dignity, respect, and courtesy. And I just want to go out today and say today's show is dedicated to the memory of Lee Mize and all the great, great things that he did. Let's go out and celebrate the end of a great American life. Thank you. And we'll be back next week on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man. Thought about never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my.
Yeah.